This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, March 30th, 2011.
Thank you, Amy. I should have pushed the button. The first item is the minutes from the March 16th meeting. Has anybody read them?
I'd like to I would like to see in the minutes that there was some discussion about things that are measurable versus meaningful when we talked about suicide.
How do you want me to word that then?
You could write it that way if you want.
There was some discussion of the difference between measurable and meaningful.
Okay. Are there other corrections, additions, deletions, emendations, or yes?
Excuse me. It might be worth mentioning in the context of point eight that, if my memory serves, Randy did suggest that there be discussion of the child care subcommittee. I don't know if we actually did discuss it or if that's minute worthy. I know it was in one of your emails.
There was discussion. I recollect there was discussion.
I don't think I see that. I know there's mention of subcommittees and mention of membership, but
mm-hmm.
We put it off for today.
Right.
There's discussion, less discussion.
Okay. Any other? I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that could be inserted into the final sentence of the anti-penultimate paragraph of that section. It was agreed that they would carry over this discussion. You know.
Excellent. Any objections from anybody?
No.
Well, then, with these changes, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes? Oh my gosh, everybody's in agreement. Fine. Anybody opposed? Thank heavens for that. Late additions to the agenda. We do have a little time because Joe Lally is not going to be able to join us today for whatever reason. Okay. I'd like to take just 2 minutes to tell you that we have just had a visit from the Middle States Visiting Committee to consider whether Cornell should be accredited. And this matters because if Cornell were not accredited, we couldn't accept any federal grants, and that would make a lot of us unhappy. And so we have spent about 2 years developing a huge document, which then shrank down to a quite modest sized document. And the visiting committee came and they visited, and then today they gave us the report, and you will all be relieved to hear that we were found satisfactory.
Oh, thank you.
But of course with a couple of recommendations, and they don't seem too serious, fortunately, but we'll see what they actually turn out to be. But in any event, that's good, and some of us on the UA met with the group yesterday and told them that we weren't being consulted enough and early enough and often enough, and that they reported duly to the assembled multitudes this morning as a general comment from shared governance, which is probably true. And I met several of the administrators afterwards who said, we aren't consulted early enough and often enough either. And,
but they were afraid to say it.
No. Yeah.
So I remember when we had this discussion on Middle States low those many months ago, that one of the big pushes was an assessment. So great that we're good now, but I wonder if you have any sense, or if they gave any sense, of what sort of things we can expect to see over the next decade, I guess, as we move towards the next reaccreditation in terms of trying to put more emphasis on assessment.
Their view of what we were doing was that we were doing very well and that we ought to keep doing it. And that I think one of the recommendations, I think that's the right word, but anyway, one of the things they're going to monitor, they're going to watch us, is to see that we actually follow through on these things. And what's going to happen at the next time to assessment, who knows? mean, you have no child left behind, and clearly there's going to be a no college student left behind, or equivalent, and I just
you
don't know.
You have to take the SATs again after you graduate.
Yeah, right. See if you do any better.
Yeah.
And those that do worse.
It could be good to go down.
I didn't have to write the SATs.
Anyway, I think it's a really, I think the whole assessment business is a very tough problem. And I am reminded of a meeting, I'm sorry, I'm going to take two more minutes. I'm reminded of a meeting that Gerald Zacharias, who was an educator, a reformer at MIT, a group of us had at Endicott House, in which we invited all the heads of ETS and all these test companies. And Zach began the meeting by saying he was going to develop a felony proneness test, and he was going to get it validated at the 80% level, and then he was going to give it to the population as a whole, and anybody who flunked would be locked up. And the people from ETS, I remember, turned purple in the face and smoke peered out their ears because, you know, it was such a attack on this whole business of standardized testing, and that your whole future hangs on that kind of measure as opposed to a much more holistic kind of measure. Anyway, enough of this. Okay, we've not heard any late additions to the agenda.
Question, is there a timeline on when that information is going to get released?
Yeah, what's going to happen now is that in some number of weeks, and I don't remember what N is, but I think it's 2, but it may be 4, we will get a report back from the Middle States, from the visiting committee, and we get to look at the report and correct any factual errors. Then it goes to the Middle States. The Middle States looks at it and makes their own determination. And they may say things that were not in the report, or they may evaluate them differently. And we learn that result in June, just after graduation. And that's what really counts. But still, the visit was good, I think, and that's important in its own right. Anything else from anybody? Okay, Andrew, I think you're on for the Bill of Rights.
Okay. So the draft that I distributed last week has been slightly modified thanks to comments from a number of members and law professors and such, but only slightly, and I'll be sure to send that out to you shortly. Do people have the document? You do? Okay. So I'd like to go through it if anyone has stylistic suggestions or critiques. But I'd also like to make you aware of the process I'm trying to put in place with the Student Bill of Rights. I am tomorrow presenting in front of the Student Assembly Resolution 70, we're up to, calling for a constitutional convention. And this, I believe, is the best way to go about this sort of resolution, because I don't want it to just be a thing, you know, I write, people on the Student Assembly or University Assembly comment on, and then we just go ahead and pass it. I want to make it as open and democratic as possible. So the plan is that in 3 weeks, on a Thursday and Friday afternoon, I will have the entire Student Assembly in attendance, along with hopefully some graduate students and law students, and if that might be down there, if that to have all these community members in attendance, and then to have a panel of academics and faculty there to a couple of them will help put this event into context, those who have a historic knowledge of the university and students' rights and different events that have happened on campus that have spurred kind of a movement and a change in the governance process that kind of put this event into context. And then from there, a lot of lawyers will be on the panel, and the judicial administrator, hopefully, and the university ombudsman, and with the support of the Dean of Students Office, and in a very collaborative approach, working on amending this initial document with their advice to come up with something within the 2-day convention. And the plan is is to get as many community members involved as possible so that they can break up into groups, draft resolutions with the help of SA members, and then come to the floor with a bunch of resolutions to amend the document and to debate these amendments. And at the end of the day, it could be something totally different than the document that's been in front of you. That document right there. And so that is the plan for now, and currently I'm pinning down, and I think I'd appreciate if the faculty could help me on this, different academics who could contribute to either explaining the history of Cornell University in terms of campus governance and the social movements, or to be advisors to the students when they put this thing together and make amendments. So that is the plan from, and the student assembly will be talking about this resolution, calling for the convention tomorrow. And we don't want to reinvent the wheel, so I give them a draft of the Student Bill of Rights, and this is close to the latest draft I have, and that I'll distribute to them, and they'll work from that, and they'll make amendments, and they'll debate those amendments on these constitutional topics with the help of advisors, and that will be the deal. Now, what I'd like from you is, number one, when we finally get through this convention, I'll be bringing the Bill of Rights back in resolution form. For now, I want you to forget any of those whereas clauses I gave you originally. And we'll rewrite it in resolution form, and we'll try to pass it to this assembly with your additional comments. And if you could help me in critiquing the draft before I distribute it during the convention, and if you could help me in talking to your colleagues and people from your assemblies to get them to show up and to be delegates at the convention, to help, that would be good. So I guess I'll open it up to
Walter Lynn would be a good person to invite to know the history of the government of Cornell.
Another one would be Bob Cook.
Who?
Bob Cook. J. Robert Cook, who was dean of faculty.
And I'd like to suggest the kind of global change. That, there's nothing in here about the students' rights being had on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming that these rights are rights you want to encourage for people to exercise. So a student shall be free and are encouraged to express opinions publicly and throughout where it says free.
Especially in my case, freedom in the classroom, students shall be free.
Right. I actually, in the latest draft, I changed that just to add a buzzword and to invite a faculty senate committee on academic freedom into the mix. That article will now read right to academic freedom. And in addition to what was stated in there about freedom to disagree and to only be judged on your academic performance rather than political views, it will also involve selection of speakers, allocation of funds for speaker programs and other student activities to observe the principles of academic freedom and promote intellectual pluralism. That's not in the draft you have there, but that's a recent change that I think
Howie? Well, I've got two problems.
Okay.
One of them is the very first whereas. I realize you don't want to talk about it right now.
The whereas clauses will be abolished as written because
I didn't understand the first one at all.
It won't even be there.
All right, fine. Let's get rid of that. Let's go down to freedom in the classroom. Okay.
Right.
I'm a biologist, and I can imagine somebody standing up when I'm talking about the evolution of the eye and says, well, I don't believe in evolution. And I say, well, thank you very much. So I'm going to go on and tell you about it. He says, well, let me tell you why I don't believe about evolution. Well, this is not the appropriate place for you to tell me about evolution. Well, you're violating my freedom of the classroom. So where are we? I mean, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. What I said last student is that this theory has been in existence for over 150 years.
Well, I want to tell them about the eye. I don't want to get in an argument about evolution in the middle of a class that I'm running. Okay?
Well, would you consider that a political view or academic?
I consider that an academic view. I'm a teacher. Okay.
And I think that answers that. And I think the ombudsman would come up with the same answer.
Well, I think you're next.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add in maybe a clause about such that it doesn't interfere with, because like what you brought up there sounds like something that would just kind of get in the way of the overall flow of the course. So maybe like, you know, freedom in the classroom to an extent, but so that it doesn't interfere with like learning. And
we could work on the limitations when we're through with the convention, but the style, and it's not fully expressed in this, I made slight changes to read out those limitations that are in this version, but the point is not to put down things that the university would endorse right away, such as limitations to how you protest, if you're blocking entrances, and technical stuff like that. The point is to state that these are rights and freedoms, and I'm sure the university has the same view as what you just stated, but I don't want to put that in the initial draft that we're giving to the convention.
Also,
I should point out that this document cannot overturn the campus code of conduct, which has clear statements about what you can do in a classroom. So relative to what Howie said, clearly someone jumping up in a classroom, that would be disrupting. It used to be REMI. You know, I don't know whether you still use REMI and REMPO. You know, in which case you could shut them down.
Right.
Doing something outside of class, you know, would be allowed. But there are a number of things here that are either covered or more clearly defined within the campus code of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we wanted to send this to the CJC, you can't.
I'm having you
say anything that's going to change that. You can say, you know, students have a right to have sex on anywhere they want and smoke anywhere they want. You know, you couldn't do that.
It doesn't say that.
No, but I mean, you could. It doesn't have. It wouldn't matter because, you know, you can't change the campus code. So
you're right. The foundation for this will have to be the campus code of conduct. And I do have meetings scheduled with Mary Beth Brand on Friday morning. The judicial administrator, as you know, and I think that the real purpose of this is not to be a technical document like a campus code of conduct where it's just, where it does say something about rights, but it's mainly a list of regulations. You can't do this, you can't do that. This is to be a simplified tool for students so that they understand basically that they have the same rights that they would have in a public institution. And it's used primarily as a tool, and it will have some policy effect, but it will make sure not to conflict with any existing policies, and in fact to make existing policies clearer and more outright and simple.
You made a statement that goes back to the preamble. That you specifically say private institutions. That implies that all these rights are already present in the ag school? Say there.
No, because Cornell University
is a private institution.
Cornell University as a whole is a private institution. Those are
not my grant. College isn't a private institution. That's a land grant, private institution.
It's a land grant college.
I get
but it's Cornell University Corporation.
My dean goes and talks to the assembly. Right. You know, my college is a statutory college. I'm a state employee.
Right.
You know, I'm not private. Right. So
I do think
I don't know the technicality.
I do.
I know this.
Can you?
The rights of students at this university, whether in your school or any other school, do not have the same bill of rights that would apply to them if they went to a straight public institution.
Really? You said something to say, Charlie?
Yes, but I think it's not particularly relevant.
I was just curious. Maybe I've been wrong all these years.
Technically, Cornell is a private institution. The ag school is private. The vet school is private. However, we have a contract with the state of New York, which says that they will support this. And in so doing, there are, as you point out, state employees and state pensions and all those good things associated with it. But technically, that's why they call them contract colleges now. It's to make that distinction very clear that these are not, in fact, statutory colleges.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably how the state got away with being able to cut funding down to like 20%.
Sure.
Exactly. It's not a real state school. It's only a portion.
Sure.
Getting back to Howie's point, I would definitely agree with Ellis. I think as a professor, you maintain the right to not argue with the student. You have to let that student express their views, but as a professor, you can definitely cut them off and move on with your lecture.
Because you I don't think the civil rights would get in the way of that.
Absolutely not. Also, in terms of the freedom to protest, I know the university has procedures right now in terms of where you can or cannot, or when you can or cannot protest or have a certain campaign on campus, particularly on the art squad. Do you know if that freedom to protest might raise some flags with the administration?
I apologize that it's... Well, this won't answer your question, but the freedom to protest is in the latest, very latest version, which is today, is now freedom of... I emerged on freedom of expression, protest, and association. And so to go with the thing where we're not going to write limitations, such as, you know, if a student's jumping up and down, I don't want to include that in the Bill of Rights, so we're striking this, and if students shall be free to protest anywhere on the Cornell campus, will be added up here. I didn't get into the limitations on that. I think that is more of the university's job and something the university would expect to enforce otherwise. But
so
I think the general freedom to protest peacefully anywhere.
Andrew, I wonder.
I think that's a good start.
That's a very smart move to move it up there. I like that. It's not on.
Right.
Andrew, I wonder if it would make more sense, rather than to discuss this now here, to wait until you've been through the forum where you're going to get a whole lot of different suggestions and different interpretations, and then bring us back.
There'll be debate. The reason, and I'll get to you in a second, the reason I bring it up now is because I'm going to give these students, well, it's twofold. I'm going to give these students this initial draft, and this initial draft will obviously frame the discussion. So if you want to affect the original framing of the discussion, we should affect it now. And as for, I forgot the other thing, but Randy.
Oh, I want to say something that has to do with the UA and speaks to what Alan that in the preamble, if it says to preserve a culture of tolerance, promote higher learning, abide by the campus code of conduct, comma, and that's the campus code of conduct comes through the UA. So that really is a good thing for us to put our stamp on.
You'd like to include the what do people think about including abide by the campus code in the preamble?
I think it makes a great deal of sense.
Right.
You don't want to set anybody up for failure.
Exactly.
If it's your Article 3, I can't, you know, and they didn't read the research as to all the caveats and buts.
Right.
And the campus code is
the public safety.
Like, not a punishment code, but a how to make a good university.
Mm-hmm. Well, theoretically, yeah.
I haven't had a panel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Even?
Well, my question, to step aside from language, and I know we've talked about this before, is about process. So, of course, this document is maybe not directly modeled after, but certainly inspired by the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
That document is governing for the United States government, and all powers of that government flow from the Constitution. So if you have an issue, you can go up the chain, until you get to the Supreme Court. And then ultimately they decide what does this particular passage in the Constitution mean. This document, no matter how wonderful the forum and all the great things we say and whether we ratify them, whatever, will not have that same standing. And that's, you know, campus code of conduct. Does it matter whether or not it's in the preamble? Well, in some sense, no, because it's not. The campus code of conduct will remain binding on students whether or not it's in the preamble to this document. So this is my long way of saying, how do you envision this process working?
Okay, and that's a good question. What I do agree that the campus code might serve a purpose being put in the preamble, simply because what this document overall will not only be a lesson for all students in civic rights at the convention, but it will be a tool that they could use, a simplified two-page version of what they could expect to be protected from at this university, rather than the campus code of conduct, which I am sure barely anyone actually reads until they get in trouble. And so I think that overall the mission is to be a useful and guiding tool, an independent document that will take all the UA, the GPSA, and the SA to modify and to change, and shall be endorsed by the President of the University. I think that it's more of a list of rights than a list of don'ts, which differs from the campus code. And the reason, beyond framing the discussion for the convention, the reason I'd like to bring it to you is that I'd like to get faculty members, graduate students especially, because that's going to be harder, and all your friends to be delegates at the convention or to help at the convention and to kind of lend a level of gravitas to this event to make it somewhat historic.
So if I could just finish on that point.
Certainly.
You see what I'm saying. I mean, my dorm room is searched in a manner not in keeping with this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I can't then go to the president of the university and say, well, you violated the rights in this document.
Right.
And I could say you violated my constitutional rights, this, that, or the other, or you violated this university policy, because those are binding on the university in some sense. I agree the constitution is complicated, but you see what I'm saying. When it's round up like this, I mean, that's wonderful and it's great, and I agree that it's helpful, but I think that you risk giving students the sense that...
With issues like privacy, which will, I'm sure, be heavily debated at that convention, that it's a very good point, and that is for a conversation I have not had yet with the university ombudsman. I envision that this document should be supported by administrators such as the JA and the ombudsman's office, and for it to be enforced in any way, it needs to have their backing. So I will have a conversation with them about enforcement. Unfortunately, I'm not there yet, and I can't give you the full answer.
I have another thing, but I'll get back in the line.
Okay.
Jerry? I was rather mouthful. Oh, I'm sorry.
So, really, 2 points. I suppose this document could be used as guiding principles for us who make policy and adjudicate the campus code as to a viewpoint that we should ensure we are sensitive to when changing the campus code or other issues come before us. But fundamentally, I kind of have, maybe it's a different shade of what Evan's talking about. What are we trying to solve? What is it that you want President Scorton to sign on to that isn't happening?
Mm-hmm.
That because getting the details on a document like this is going to be very hard and very labor intensive, as you can already see.
Right.
And nobody here would be against, in theory, any of these, but the details matter.
Right. And I don't think what I've written is... too far away from what we already have in different university policies. But to answer your question, I think that the impetus for this is just the natural power differentials that occur on campus, whether it's between faculty and student, RA and resident, government and student. I mean, we've had in the past faculty that will berate a student on their political views. We've had in the past a student organization that will tell you can't be a member because of your sexual orientation. We've had different instances where a document like this could be guiding. A student assembly member has proposed resolutions trying to take the Cornell name off of a publication because of things that they said. So in terms of instances on campus, and RA advisors, I'm sure, have barged into rooms without cause. So I think that the overall theme is to negate that power differential that naturally occurs and to be a useful tool for all students to look at and to think this is the way business is run.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel like more than trying to solve problems on campus directly, I think Andrew is trying to make students feel protected, right? You want to make them feel like we're here for them. So something like probable cause, you already need probable cause to get into that room.
No. We don't.
Not, well, no, if you look at the housing stuff, I think RAs do have the right to go into a room if they find that there is something going on there. But I think ultimately, even if there are protections that already exist, this is going to be there to just show students that like it's very explicit and very apparent that we are proactive about guiding them and also protecting them.
Okay, I think, yes.
One final thing on timeline. Speaking of graduate students and right. all of that, I mean, I've got an A exam in 3 weeks. I imagine other people have. I mean, it's the end of the semester. This mm-hmm. is a busy time.
Mm-hmm.
There are only two GPSA meetings left this year. One of them will be electing new people. The other one will be electing new officers. The chance, I think, even if everybody supported it in every detail and there was no discussion, the chance of it being ratified in this session of the GPSA is minimal. Again, even if everybody agrees with everything,
to,
and,
to be honest, so if you don't pass it till next year.
So you do see this as a process that would continue past. That's basically my question.
Right. I mean, I would appreciate it if you would make every effort you can to get GPSA members at the convention, to get them participating and to notify them of what's going on, keep them abreast with all these issues. But as for final passage of this document, if it occurs next year, so be it. I'm sure other people will be ready to pick up the reins.
I think the single best way to ensure, and then I'll stop talking, to ensure that people will attend and be engaged in a forum of this nature would be to get some sort of, maybe this isn't even possible, some sort of stamp from the administration that they're going to take the outcome seriously.
I agree with you, which is why I've already requested that the Dean of Students or the President of the University come by during the dinner to give a few words of encouragement to all the members, as well as have the Judicial Administrator and Ombudsman in attendance. So I think we'll try and have them involved, which is why I'm deleting those whereas clauses. I mean, I would like a very simple, a convention, whereas the convention was convened on April, whatever, whereas this is the product, and be there for resolve, pass this bill of rights, something like that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Andrew. We now come to the approval of the Judicial Codes Counselor, and I have a communication here from somebody who claims to be David J. Scorton, which says, on the recommendation of the Judicial Codes Counselor Search Committee, I am pleased to name you to serve as the next Judicial Codes Counselor for the term beginning July 2012 and ending June 30th, 2013. And in the meantime, your assistant, J.C. And the question is, do we approve of this appointment?
So moved.
Seconded.
Okay. Is there further discussion?
Does it begin July 2012 or 2011?
It begins 2012 because you begin
as judicial administrator. Oh. They served as assistant before that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're a first year law student now, and the second year they do.
It's kind of as what is said about a Harvard baby dean. It's a mouse in training to be a rat. I'm sorry. I was very unkind, but there are no deans present.
Learn something new every day. I should clear up the whole felony thing.
So, any further discussion? All in favor of the motion? All opposed? It's passed unanimously. Thank you very much. And this takes us to my most favorite thing, which is the bylaws. And the question is how to approach the bylaws. And I guess the answer is very carefully. Ari has provided a new version, which I'm looking at here, which says March 16th, 2011, a bylaws draft. And I think probably the first thing to do is to ask whether there are changes that need to be made to this draft before we pass it. Randy.
Didn't we discuss that the hearing, the traffic hearing board or whatever its actual name was, would be a subcommittee?
I don't remember what happened to that. Ari, would you explain, please?
I was at the last meeting you added as an associated committee.
But I actually had a question about that. How this came out was, I forget his name, asked Ed if we could staff that committee. Is there a way, theoretically, never mind the language in front of us or whatever, that we could staff a committee without it being an associated committee, that we could use the staffing assembly website?
Well,
need to be on our
there's
bylaw.
A little bit of a an oddity there. I think the transportation hearing and appeals board is pretty analogous to the university hearing and review boards. And the way that we handle the campus code of conduct is in the new charter analogous to the traffic and parking regulations. However, the traffic and parking regulations don't contain a charge or detailed instructions for convening the transportation hearing and appeals board and how that's supposed to work. There just seems to be sort of an informal reference to the UA's authority over that. But the UA has never really had that authority spelled out clearly the way it does for the hearing and review boards.
Right.
So I think in the long term, not an urgent thing, it might be good to have a parallel statement in the authority section of the UA charter that the UA has authority over staffing this group. And in the long term, the Department of Transportation should have the staffing procedures for the hearing and appeals board and its exact role spelled out in its own traffic rules instead of having it sort of tacked on to the UA's bylaws.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, this is word for word what was in the old UA charter, which had it as a committee.
Right. Yeah.
Just a standing committee of the UA.
Are there other issues that we should discuss? Evan?
You're going to be so sick of me. I've got a whole list of things. I'll leave out most things. Under section 3.2.1, as I read point 5, it says the same thing as points 2 and 3. Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
You said section 3.2.1.
I don't have that.
3.2.1.5.
So, 2 says submit minutes, 3 says submit an annual report, 5 says file in a timely manner minutes and an annual report. Could we strike point 5 and it wouldn't change anything? Am I reading this correctly? Although maybe it's good because, you know, if they read point 4, which is granted 3 lines long, and they've forgotten it.
Right.
We make sure that they're doing it right
in
their
end. Unless the intent of 5 is to publicly post on our website.
Yeah, maybe 5 is filed different than submit.
It submitted, like you're saying, for the first time filed, like tour for the future.
It also doesn't say timely in points 2.
Well, yeah.
Can I offer that?
Fine point.
We'll probably have to miss one. We had the vice chair for operations. We did not notice that. That 5 was already there.
Okay.
So I think it is.
You're okay with striking 5, and you think that they say essentially the same thing?
Yeah, except 2 and 3 point to a specific office to direct things to instead of
right.
The assembly, which is a little bit vague.
We could stick timely in there somewhere, couldn't we?
In 2 and 3?
I don't think we need to for 3 because it already specifies the time. But
oh, okay.
Maybe 2.
2 would work.
Yeah.
Submit in a timely fashion.
Right. Sure.
With the meeting of minutes.
Okay. Even the next one.
Continuing on down, 2.8 is on the minutes. We of course keep written minutes, but we also have an audio recording. This is actually a question 2. That I had. 2.8. This isn't.
We're going backwards now.
I'm trying to go in order of what I feel is important, so that when you invariably cut me off, the stuff at the end is important stuff.
He is a smart one.
Yeah.
So it doesn't talk about the audio recording that is posted online, and there are, I think the biggest issue with that is, and this is what made me think about it, is it said that portions of the meeting conducted in executive session don't go into the minutes. Does the audio recording get stopped at that point? And the bigger question is basically, should the fact that an audio recording is made at the meeting and posted online be listed in the bylaws analogous to the way we do minutes? Because it's effectively oral minutes.
What do people think? I would offer the suggestion that, that there ought to be no recording during executive session, for one. What about the other point?
So that means that we need to, in some sense, well, invariably, we start specifying the fact that an audio recording is made. Maybe the best way to do that is to add a subsection, 2.8.1, audio recording.
Evan, is the purpose of the audio recording, although we post it so that minutes can be typed, or is it to give a blow-by-blow for historical sake?
Right.
I mean, are we committing to audio minutes from now forever, even though we do it now?
Yeah.
And what do we consider the official source document? The minutes are approved in the following meeting.
That's right.
I'd say they're the congressional record as advised and amended,
right.
And that the audio recording is a bonus, but mainly for the transcribers, and
but
it's easy to post, so
that's,
they have.
That's a good point. If it's for the, if it's to help in transcribing the minutes, and solely that, then it really shouldn't be posted.
I don't mind it's posted, but I'm not sure
either.
That I want it to be the default source, because I don't want a Watergate situation with the missing 8 minutes. You know, if technology lets us down or something.
I mean, we do not approve the audio minutes.
Right.
We approve the written minutes.
Period.
So that's what this should refer to.
The audio minutes are pretty much undisputable.
That's not my voice.
We don't all have mics right in front of us. You know, sometimes the
exactly.
This thing doesn't pick up, you know, everybody's statements up as well. It's an imperfect system. Let's just leave it out. It's a bad
right. Right. I agree.
Okay.
I could offer for our office to write something down somewhere that would be our official policy on audio recordings and how long they're guaranteed to live. I don't want to guarantee that they live more than a year, because you never know when we're going to run out of space or something like that.
I think the point is the written minutes that are the official record of this body's deliberations, and that the audio recording is something which is useful, and we feel comfortable sharing it most of the time. I just think we ought not to address it.
I agree.
Next one.
Final point, very small, 2.10, says that the executive board must publicize and allow people to attend all meetings of the assembly, fine, and its committees. Do we want to make it the responsibility of the executive board of this group here to publicize meetings and ensure attendance of committees and subcommittees?
No.
Realistically.
I mean, that seems like, well,
yeah, it's hard to
see issues with that. It should be the responsibility, I think, of the heads of those committees to publicize their own meetings. And so I suppose my amendment, if I would offer an amendment, would be to strike "and its committees" from the end of that.
What do people think about getting rid of "and the committees"?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I haven't heard any loud screams of anguish, so let's get rid of "and the committees."
Just for the audio recording, my intent is not that they.
Yeah.
So when they're it's not that they not be open and publicized, just that it not be the responsibility of the executive or the people in this room to do it.
Thank you.
And it does say elsewhere that they have to publicize and hold so many meetings and ensure input.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Did we agree to strike
that?
Yeah. Yes, we did.
We did. I couldn't get any objections.
I'm done.
Well, that wasn't too painful.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have other things that need to be fixed in this division before we go on?
It's going on about the child care.
Yeah, that we're coming to. All right. I think what we should do is adopt this draft of the bylaws. Yes, Mike.
I'm sorry. 322?
322.
Did we settle the... I haven't been fully updated on the draft. Unless I was specified in the church, then we'll have 8 voting members. What about the members of the university assembly that are...
Well, at least one has to be a voting member, so at least four of the eight are going to be voting members of the assembly.
The next thing, of the two members, you know, should just one be voting.
I thought we reframed this last 2 weeks ago. In it that the each standing committee would have three members from the UA and then two members from each constituency, one of whom was a member of each constituency assembly.
For a total of 11.
For a total of 11.
I remember that conversation, but I don't.
Let me consult a minute.
Because this is based on a back of the envelope calculation I did that model, and I think I can for
do the minutes reveal anything of a helpful nature?
The minutes reveal that M. Walsh said exactly what M. Walsh remembers himself saying.
Oh my gracious. Think of it. Sorry.
I could check the audio recording.
No.
I just didn't mean
it. But it doesn't specify in minutes, and I don't think we did this 2 weeks ago or however many weeks ago it was, that we came to a decision. We discussed that, we discussed other things.
And it was kind of left.
And then we said we'll talk about this more next time.
And I like this 11, you know, three from UA and then two from each constituency, because I think it allows for each constituency to have a lot more buy-in to this whole process and still allows UA to basically run the show with each of these committees with a critical mass of membership on each of these committees, while not at the same time terribly depleting our time or the UA members' time. And I think with this model, we would have to have 12 members on the three committees total, whereas with the 11-person model, we have three members, so nine members of the UA, and then there are members of the UA involved in other things that will take up their time. So and it was a time management that brought this model, I think, to the forefront.
How would this read now, then?
So, unless specified otherwise, each standing committee will have eleven voting members, consisting of two members appointed by each constituent assembly, one of whom must be a voting member of each constituent assembly. The other three members will be members of the university assembly.
Sorry, how do we get to 11 again?
Two members from each constituency appointed by each constituency assembly, one of which must be a voting member of each constituency, plus three members from the UA.
One question. The way that 322 reads right now, there's a diversity requirement in the UA members of the committee. They have to get four. There are four minimum, and they have to be from separate constituencies. Under the language you just posited, it could be three, and they could be three employees, three faculty, three.
Mm-hmm. I'm not too worried about that because we basically have a constituency representation already embedded in that model. Okay.
I guess it's kind of difficult for me because I want to say something about, you know, the committee dynamics, and I hope I'm not stepping on toes, but
turn the recorder on.
Well, you know, we had the conversation about the committee model. So was this debate about should the committees be mostly composed of UA members or shouldn't they? And this concern, which I certainly feel is one of the biggest problems with the committee structure we have right now, which is that there's hardly any UA representation at all on these committees, and as a result, they're often quite out of touch with the UA. And they might be doing great things. Like, I know the Transportation Committee meets regularly, and it discusses transportation issues, and I'm sure that what Joelle was going to present on this evening was something that he had discussed with them, but this assembly hardly hears about it and certainly doesn't understand it very well. And I don't think this is just a problem with the UA, although it's extreme in the UA, because up until very recently, the UA had a categorical ban on its members being voting members of the committees. So, in addition to that, when Tommy Bruce and Jim Engel have talked about delegated authority and this vision of having the committees hold hearings and public meetings and really do a lot of the core work of formulating recommendations, based off the principle of having the elected body, the representative body, have a controlling interest in the committee, of having most of its voting membership was really important. So this seems to just, if we went this way, it would sort of set aside that whole hybrid model, and I don't see that as being a good shift. I think this shift away from how UA has done things is actually a positive development.
As it stands right now, though, it's not a majority. It's theoretically, it's at least half. Does that change things?
Personally, I would be happiest with all UA members on the UA committee.
Congressional model.
The congressional model, yes.
Senate model.
And I think
U.S. Senate for the minute.
I think that's correct me if I'm wrong here. I think it's also a model for our board of trustees for the other committees.
The objection, and you know, the objection from people like the child care subcommittee is that, you know, it's important to have membership. I agree with you. I've said that before. I think that is a very good way to do it. But their objection is that there's a sort of community buy-in thing by having someone from the Ithaca City School District and someone from, you know, well, other people with kids. I don't know who has kids. Other important child caring people involved as members of the committee increases the utility and the buy-in and so on and so. Again, clearly the congressional model works. Well, you know, putting aside what you think about
which
that,
Congress?
It does something. I mean, you can tell it is the amount. It's a dramatic shift, and I think it's a good shift, but I think we need to be very careful in how we manage that. And that we say it's not about excluding voices. We foresee public hearings. The meetings will be open. The minutes will be posted. We want to hear your views, et cetera, et cetera. But this framework is in place to ensure communication, to ensure back and forth, and to ensure, perhaps most importantly, that the committee's recommendations are taken seriously when they get to this body. The issue that we all think of, again, is the child care in the fall, where our subcommittee had one position and we had a different position because we weren't in communication with each other. That's not to say we were right and they were wrong or vice versa. We had very different positions and different reasons for holding those positions, because we had formulated something based on different evidence using a different procedure and weren't aware of what they were doing. So to avoid that sort of thing, it's not about taking power away from the committee, but about making sure that there's, well, anyway, I'm repeating myself now.
So would you end up then with this model, which is going to ensure that we have at least four UA members on each committee, whereas the other technique gets you three UA members on each committee. Four is, a more substantial proportion of eight than three is of 11. So are you arguing for the present scheme here?
I suppose what I'm really arguing for is the Senate scheme, where all the members are, but that's, I don't, pursuant to Mike's point about time management, I don't think that is tenable. I mean, one of the things that came up in my mind was, of course, now the heads of the constituent assemblies are voting members of this body. Being the president of the GPSA should not be a full-time job. If you're a graduate student first, you're the president of the GPSA as a sort of side thing that takes a couple of hours a week. If it's 40 hours a week, nobody's going to do it.
And then on top of
that,
we have, you know, four members who are going to be serving on the executive committee, and now we have three subcommittees of the UA and then two or three associated committees. And I'm just, and, you know, I understand the concern and I understand, you know, the desire to shift to something new, but I think we can achieve a lot of the things that Tommy has recommended, you know, under this model as well. And really ensure that the communities, the constituencies at large, feel that they have a share in this whole process, not just process from the top, you know, going down, but in every separate level. And, you know, I see that with one person right now, especially on the, you know, the sustainability committee that I'm chairing and have this conversation with Ed, you know, that there is a disconnect. There is this, you know, feeling in the room that, you know, this is just kind of this committee that's on the leash, but that's jumping all over the place. But I think with three people from the university assembly and then another four people who are, you know, involved in each assembly, that committee will be highly tied to this body and to the whole process that goes on.
Tommy?
Yeah, I think on this I agree with Mike. I think the point of overload on this committee and the people around it is a serious one. I've always found that it's much more important to have a voice in something than have a vote in it. If you're there to say things, that's what really counts. And I think with three members from this committee, even if the whole crowd is against them, they can still sit there and say, whatever you think is going to happen, the assembly is not going to pass it. I mean, be realistic, folks. That's a very powerful argument. So I think there would be enough power from this assembly on the committees with three. Do you have it?
Okay. Other comments about this? I suggest we take a straw vote and just see where we all come down on the this. Sorry.
There are some other things that I was focused on the representational aspect, but there are also some practical issues with how our committees have functioned, being dependent on other assemblies to staff them. And usually they're the lowest priority to get staffed, so they get staffed with whoever's left over after each assembly has staffed its own committees. And sometimes assemblies don't even act when there are applications in queue for these committees, just because it's that far off their radar. If there's a problem with a member not attending or bringing an agenda that has nothing to do with that assembly's view of how things should be done, I can't think of an instance where an assembly has acted to remove a member because they didn't attend meetings or because they were disrupted in meetings, even when they called on those members to bring agenda items to the committees. So I guess one other question I have, and I think it would be worthwhile to talk this out a little bit more, is what would make this system different now?
I think the big thing with that is that we now have the executives from each assembly, the person who's responsible, you know, at the end of the day, the buck stops here, the person who's responsible for staffing and ensuring that their assembly is well represented, you know, across the university. And so we now have this tie directly from, you know, a member of the committee. They can, or a UA-appointed member to one of these committees can come to this meeting and say, hey, Evan, the new person of the GPSA, your, you know, slots in this committee aren't completely staffed. Get that done. We want a graduate student voice here. I know this is a completely new model, and I certainly, you know, recognize the concern that you have, but I really think that this new change that we're doing with this body, by including the executives, is going to be a big change that's going to help alleviate that.
Well, I think that's my point. Excuse me, Alan.
I don't think that this is a new model. I think this is basically the old model.
No. It's not the old model. No, I'm sorry, I can't buy that.
Well, if most of the committee is composed of people whose only connection to the university assembly is being part of that committee. Doesn't that seem to create a situation where people, I mean, taking for example sustainability committees, there's an environmental or sustainability committee in three assemblies now. And
gradual ones, so
we got rid of that. But there were a lot of conversations about it before then, and a lot of it was basically, if you're getting rid of this committee, you're getting rid of your commitment to sustainability, and this notion that because there were people who identified the university's interest in sustainability based on whether or not it would appoint them to a committee on that subject, it made it really difficult for conversations to happen about reassembling groups to address whatever the issue was. You end up with a lot of interest committees that most of the time don't function well and are very difficult to change because you've got a group of people who are otherwise not part of the assembly whose view of their influence in the assembly is based on whether or not they're a member of a particular committee.
A couple of points. First off, the chair of each one of these committees is going to be a UA person. That's a big change in itself. And not only that, but there will be two other members, at least, who are UA members. So there's going to be either three or four, depending which model we want, who are UA members and who are part of this body, who will sit around this table and argue with the rest of us. So I think it's going to improve the communication business, and I think it will also set the tone for these committees because the chair is a member of this body who is responsible for the committee. So I think either one of these models will work a lot better than what we currently have, is my point.
Past committees didn't have to have anybody from this room on the committee. The committee reported to us, but we didn't have to have a single person who was a voting member on the committee. By default, that's why I can't equate the two at all. Fewer committees with direct involvement, eight or three, I think can work, and I can see some value from both. But one question I have is, what's our ability to mandate in our bylaws that the Faculty Senate will put people on our committee? I mean,
we already do that.
We do that. Have done that.
I'm sure we have.
But it doesn't work terribly.
So our historical precedent, we can tell them what we want to do in our documents that they didn't vote on. I mean, they voted on our,
It ends up showing up in the assembly staffing system as committees that they have to staff.
Okay.
So it's not that they have to read our bylaws and say, what are our bylaws telling us to do?
Well, we also have fewer committees, so in theory,
yeah,
people are creating their own committees just to have their own exploratory bodies. The number of pots that require bodies should be, or could potentially be, fewer.
Yeah.
You never know.
Hope so. Evan?
Another slightly different point on the time management issue. Under the current language, so four minimum plus four, that means that with three committees, and assuming then no overlap for the graduate professional students, each of them has to be on one committee. This is different than the three other constituencies. The other three constituencies are four plus presiding officer. Graduate and professional students are two plus presiding officer, so three total. So that means that for graduate and professional students, we would be the only constituency required under the current language, assuming no overlap, to have our presiding officer also serve on an additional committee. And again, I worry about turning the presiding officer position of the GPSA specifically into a full-time job. So now they're chair of the executive board, they're chair of the GPSA, they're a voting member of the university assembly, and they're on a university assembly committee minimum. And that differs from the three other constituencies because we have fewer members.
Mm-hmm. Should we add non-members?
Not that I need to. I don't think this solves the time management problem, but it wouldn't necessarily. You could have one of the other two members serve on one of them.
You certainly could, yeah. Like I said, assuming no overlap, that's an issue.
Yeah. Okay, how are we going to come to some resolution here as between 8 and 11? Can we just have a show of hands about how many people favor 8? How many people favor 11? How many people favor forgetting the whole thing and going out for a beer? my reading of the vote was rather strongly in favor of 11, but I feel...
But, I mean, it happens to answer, if it's about communication, then 11 with three UA members is fine. If it's about control, about the UA having control over its committee, then exactly what Ari is saying, that if, that you want to make sure that you're not dramatically outnumbered.
Again,
what
Professor Howland.
Again, I think the point that control comes from numbers is usually wrong. Usually control comes from force of argument. And
look at Wisconsin.
Okay, but if in fact we have a committee
sometimes
who says, no, we're not going to pay attention to you three. We really want this, okay?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, take this to the Assembly.
Thanks.
What's the Assembly going to do? Our three members are going to say, hey, we thought this was crazy, and here's why. The Assembly's not going to pass it. They're not going to let that happen. I mean, that's control.
Okay. Yes, sir.
If I may, I move the wording that would favor the 11.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. Is there a second? Okay. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, I will ask for a vote on the motion that's on the floor with a second. All in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Ten are in favor. How many are opposed?
One.
One opposed. How many are abstaining? One abstention. Two abstentions. Okay. I fear that the motion has passed. The majority wins. All right.
You have a right to fear.
There's nothing to fear but fear itself.
I know.
We
might get a slightly different version.
No,
it's on the audio recording.
Yeah.
It'll take minutes.
Right. The chair is going to have enough trouble finding a meeting time of 8. Good luck on 11.
Yeah, right.
I can't do it with 5.
Okay.
I wanted to say, because you'll never be able to get to the 11 people in a room. But little do you know, quorum is 1. So.
Oh,
okay. gentlemen, can we proceed? Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, can we proceed to vote on the bylaws as we have just amended them?
We still get to talk about that.
Yeah, you do, but not until we pass the wretched bylaws. For the moment,
we need
a motion to approve.
So moved. Second.
All right. Any further discussion? How many people are in favor of the bylaws? 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 are in favor. Opposed? Abstaining. Okay, and one abstention. All right. Now, let's talk about the child care.
So I just want to say I think it's one of the most effective committees that the UA has ever had. Human Resources asked us initially to have the committee. Linda Paul Howell from here spoke about how effective that committee is. I've been meeting with that committee, or going to their meetings since November or something. I think it's an extremely effective committee. I would hate to be a member of any committee that says, any group that says, any committee that has invested so much time, so much effort, has been so reasonable in their thinking, so effective in their information gathering, and committed to what they're doing won't exist as part of the UA because it doesn't fit in a pre-described pattern of committees. So I think that's all I want to say because we've heard how effective the committee is.
But Randy, the question I would raise with you is given the structure, how would it make sense? Wouldn't it make sense to have this a subcommittee of one of these other things that we have generated?
That's right.
Campus welfare.
Yes.
Campus welfare.
Subcommittee. Just write it in there as a subcommittee of the campus welfare committee to acknowledge all the people that are on that committee and all the hard work and commitment. That
I don't think you need any of that, but I okay, Evan?
How, if you might suggest, how is Article 3.1 inadequate?
Can we go to 3.1?
Is that right? Of the bylaws.
That
says that they can establish such ad hoc committees or subcommittees as are necessary for the proper performance of their function.
Because he wants them more explicit.
Yeah. But they... Why? If I may ask. Not that I disagree.
Because somebody could say, well, the president made his own child care committee, so there's no need for this committee. And like I said, they've been so effective, really, even though there were problems, they were so effective that I think they deserve to be in the charter.
I'm just trying to imagine how this, you know, I try to put myself in this frame of mind and drafting a charter and bylaws. How is this going to look in 5, 10, 20 years, whatever? Maybe that's unrealistic, but what's to stop?
The population is going up.
Well, no, but what I mean is that, so let's say today we put the child care subcommittee as a subcommittee of campus welfare into the bylaws today. What's to stop next year's UA or 5 years later from saying, well, we don't need that anymore?
Nothing.
Exactly, but
as it is
you see what I'm saying? Once the new committee takes effect, they can feel free to create or not create and in any given year whether or not they have that committee. In the same way that the body itself can decide whether or not to amend its bylaws in any given year to have that committee or not. So though we write it down today, say, theoretically, we end up with the same outcome, a committee that may or may not exist depending on the will of a particular group of people in a given year.
As is true for every single thing in the bylaws.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Jerry?
I think it's up to us as an assembly to reach out to them to the extent that we invite them to come and give updates and stuff like that and show them respect in that matter rather than putting them in the charter or bylaws. I just don't see how it fits in there.
The possible solution that I thought of to this is that instead of amending the charter or bylaws, is it conceivable that we draft a resolution of some kind that basically directs the campus welfare committee to form a subcommittee of this kind for next session and then that way we can, because the idea is that we have these committees that are more powerful, that are more bought in, and that we compromise that by taking, I will grant you, people who are interested and engaged and work hard, and by spreading them out over all of these different committees, if we can get those same people interested in the campus welfare committee and get them bought into the process, then we end up with something that is even more effective, something that builds on that great work they're already doing.
And
if such a resolution could help to transition.
I would argue in favor of keeping it the way it is. That your committee wouldn't exist if there wasn't a problem. If Bright Horizons has been wonderful, there wouldn't be a committee. There are going to be things that crop up.
No, the committee was started to ensure that things like Bright Horizons.
Yeah, but the only reason that it gained the exposure it did was because people complained. But there's committees all over the place that we could add to this. Next week it could have been, unfortunately I forgot the name. I remember the bar, but I don't remember the name. What was the forest they wanted to chop down?
Redwood.
I mean, there would be that committee because we'll never specify that. Everyone would want recognition of their particular problem committee, and we can't anticipate what all of those are. Whereas the ability to form subcommittees, which can have just as much exposure and just as much power. Now, I think that this gives us the freedom to do that. Also, I think if we put in the requirement for a subcommittee, that means there's a requirement to staff the subcommittee. Okay?
Right.
If you're going to make that a requirement, then you have to have that committee all the time, unless you're going to come before the assembly and amend the bylaws. So you can't say the subcommittee if we happen to need it at the time. So, yep, I think that we're holding all of our options open, particularly since we state that any of these standing committees are able to, as situations require, form subcommittees. In fact, that subcommittee could take over the entire function of the main committee itself. The problem was that egregious.
My ideal committee is the committee that's so effective it doesn't need to exist anymore. And going off of what else has said, I think that the Child Care and Adult Committee has done a great job so far. They've weathered this one big issue. They've steered this university through this one big issue very effectively. Now it's time, I think, to tackle new issues. And
well, they do a number of issues. It isn't just right.
Yeah, and it might need to be thought of as, you know, in a new sort of framework. And I hope this new system allows for kind of a rejuvenation of that effort and thinking about new ways and new problems that could pop up.
I have to just say I have a completely different read on human nature than most people. I imagine the UA won't have much to do with the committee and the committee won't do this.
Well, it is still covering issues beyond bright horizons and has new issues, definitely not every day, but there are new things that keep coming up, especially with birth rate expected to increase. I think it is important that we keep them in mind and also keep in mind that they're not going to fit into the structure that we're putting out here because all those people are so interested in carrying on those efforts and they do want to stay together. So it's going to be in like a different mold, and I think we have to acknowledge that we always knew it would be a hybrid system, that we would have committees that were there that didn't have that like 11 format straight up. So I don't think it needs to go in this, but I do think it's going to stay along the same lines that it has in the past.
I think
also that the UA could invite them in perhaps in the fall semester or the spring semester, like to give an update of where things are. And in that way, that's also listening and hearing the hard work that they've done and where they're at and what the latest concerns or issues are or whatever. So I think maybe the UA could be proactive and inviting them to come in, you know, like once in the fall semester and once in the spring semester for an update of some sort.
And Edward said yes this year.
Jim?
I'm trying to clarify something in my own mind. So the Child Care Committee right now is a subcommittee of the UA.
The Family Services Committee of the UA.
Okay. What is their standing now that we just passed our bylaws?
Technically, they don't.
Everything's dissolved as of when, and has to be reconstituted as of when?
May 21st or whatever. As of June 1st, the committee was ceased to exist unless it was rechartered or chartered by the next assembly of the House Committee. Until then, all of the committees and the one subcommittee, which is the Child Care Committee, are ad hoc committees of the Assembly.
But again, if I may offer, I probably didn't say this very clearly before, last year, the GPSA tried to form a sustainability committee. It didn't work. What ended up happening was in the fall, we formed an ad hoc sustainability committee, and their charge was twofold. One, to look at issues of sustainability, obviously, and the other to, you know, put forward a plan if they felt it was necessary for their continued existence. As our charter review progressed, I'd like to think that we had an open discussion, people shared their thoughts, and that we came to the decision that it was not in our best interest to have our own committee on that. But it wasn't top down. It wasn't mandated. We had, in effect, a temporary one-year ad hoc sustainability committee who would look at that issue. I wonder if we might look at something similar here. We might create an ad hoc child care committee that would look at these sorts of issues for next year. And maybe the plan is we continue to exist, and maybe it's not. But I think that looking at it as an issue of respect for their work is not the right way to frame it. I respect their work, and I respect the people. I attended one of their meetings. And I don't say this out of a lack of respect for the excellent work and time and effort that they put into it. I think about this as a way of channeling that effort into something that can be even more effective. The charge of campus welfare is not just child care, it's family support. It's broader. It's got greater authority. It's got a direct line of communication with the assembly. That, to me, can take that great work they're doing and expand upon it, rather than say, we don't value the work you're doing, so we're abolishing your commission. That's not how I think about it.
I'm wondering if Ralph, I argue the what if I can, and I'm clearly not going to, if there came to any.
Randy, I think, I was just thinking along Evan's notion. What happens if we passed a resolution here in which we simply said that we hope that the family, whatever this committee is, our legitimate committee, that essentially we would mandate that they continue the child care subcommittee for at least another year while we figure out how it makes sense to structure our various committees. I mean, I think I don't want them to feel that we have neglected them. I don't want them to feel that we don't value their activities. But it honestly, right at the moment, is awful hard to see how it all plays out.
I imagine that they'll look for a different home, so they don't have to go on a month-to-month lease commitment.
Well, maybe that's the best. I don't know.
I think it was.
I'm sorry.
Continuing resolution seems to be the order of the day. I would see nothing wrong. I would agree with you, Charles. In terms of, casting their net, they've accomplished an incredible amount with the structure they have right now. There's no difference in what they would have under this. There may be a slightly different name, okay? But if they were a full-fledged standing committee, could they have done any more? Are they going to read this and suddenly by seeing their name there, suddenly they're endowed with more respect than they had before?
This year they fought through somewhat hostile environment and came through. And where everybody came through, it came through together. And that's what I'm going to say. I don't think they need us.
Well,
the argument.
Yeah. I mean, we have nothing to offer.
Their issues are affecting all the constituent groups, so by default, we're a natural connection to them. At the same time, you want to let them know they have a home for next year while the new committee forms and actually operates as we hope it will. We've got this vision, nobody's lived it. I don't know. I think perhaps the executive board should consider transitional issues from what we have to what we will have, and perhaps leave some notes for the successors, because I was looking today and it was only four of us have 2012 appointments. I'm not one of the us, by the way.
Normal.
So the vast majority of this room will change over next year. And
that's what the audio recording
is for. Yeah, Jared.
I also think, based on our diligence, how we dealt with Bright Horizons, that whole situation from last spring through the fall, just shows that there is a home here for them, and that we do have their backs. And although we are being short of explicitly including them in our charter and bylaws, that we have taken care of them, and I think going forward they wouldn't really have any reason to leave us.
I would say again, I've said this before, that ad hoc or temporary is not an indication of status or priority or importance or anything. There are many special committees. Special is just another word for ad hoc or temporary committees in Congress that are very important to do any number of things, that write the laws that we live under. If we don't ratify them today in the remaining minutes, we're not saying we don't value the work or any of that. That's just not an issue.
mean, where else would they go, Randy?
They're not going to go to the faculty, like the student assembly?
Where else are they going to go with the university?
I don't know, but I know that they want to learn.
Ned, do you have one more? Because we are ending.
Yeah, I just think UA is the place for a function that spans across constituencies. And I think that the that ad hoc, special, whatever name you give them, that allows them to be focused on an action to be done, whether it's the time frame is a year, a month. Focus, get the job done, and not wear people out to say, I'm on a standing committee. Maybe I'll come today, maybe I won't come today. Not that everybody else does that. I'm just saying that that can be a laissez-faire attitude when you're on a standing committee. And I'm thinking an ad hoc committee can allow you to be more focused and get a job done. But I highly disagree with the fact that anything that spans across constituencies should be part of this responsibility.
Well, then to end the session, I recommend we table this issue to next meeting to see if we can think of a solution that perhaps keeps them connected while the new committee structure works.
Okay.
Because they're not going to solve it
today. Sure.
But based on my initial conversations with Brenda, they don't really have much like university assembly like pride connections as is. I think they're a very self-driven committee, and they're going to sustain themselves purely based on their like, how active they want to be.
And with that, I suggest we adjourn.
We'll just like keep in touch on that.
Right.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.